A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to know how long humans have actually been making pizza. Whether the first pizzas were what we'd now call white pizzas, since tomatoes came from the New World, and how pizza spread from a Neapolitan street food to every corner of the planet. There's a lot of myth wrapped up in the origin story here, and honestly, most of what people think they know about pizza's history is wrong.
The tomato paradox is the perfect place to start, because it's the thing that makes everyone do a double take. You think of pizza and you think of tomato sauce. It's definitional. But pizza existed for centuries without a single tomato in sight. The word itself appears in a Latin text from the year 997 in Gaeta, Italy. It's a rental agreement, and one of the payment obligations is listed as 12 pizzas. 12 pizzas as rent, which is a housing arrangement I could get behind.
Depends on the toppings. If it's anchovy pizza, I'm breaking the lease. But wait, how do we even know that 9th century pizza is the same thing we're talking about? For all we know, it could have been a lump of dough with nothing on it.
That's a fair question. And the honest answer is, we don't know exactly what that 9th century pizza looked like. The document just uses the word and assumes the reader understands what's being paid. But we have enough culinary archaeology from the period to make an educated guess. The Mediterranean basin had been producing leavened flatbreads for millennia by that point, and topping them with available fats and herbs was standard practice. So when we ask how long humans have been making pizza, we have to first decide what we mean by the word. If we mean any flatbread with stuff on top, we're talking about something that goes back to the Bronze Age. The Phoenicians, Greeks, and Romans all had oiled, herbed flatbreads. The Greeks had something called plakous. The Romans had focaccia-like breads. The word pizza probably comes from the Greek pita, or the Latin piscia, which was a flatbread baked under the ashes of a fire.
The etymology alone tells you this is ancient flatbread territory, not something that started in 1889 with a queen and a flag. But I want to pause on those Roman versions for a second, because this is where it gets interesting. The Romans weren't just eating plain flatbread. They had something called moritum, which was an herb and cheese spread that went on bread. It's basically a proto-pesto. So you've got a leavened base, you've got a cheese and herb topping, you're eating it hot. That's pizza in everything but the tomato.
The tomato is the thing everyone fixates on, which is why the timeline matters so much. Let's trace the actual sequence. Naples, in the 1700s, this is where pizza as a recognizable street food emerges. Before tomatoes, Neapolitan flatbreads were what we'd now call white pizzas, topped with lard, cheese, garlic, anchovies, sometimes basil. These were sold by pizzaioli, vendors who walked the streets with copper stoves balanced on their heads, selling slices to dock workers and laborers. This was food for the poor, something you ate standing up, folded over on itself. The original foldable slice, basically a proto-calzone approach to eating on the go.
The lard and garlic pizza, which honestly sounds like something that would either be terrible or transcendent, with no middle ground. I'm trying to imagine the flavor profile. Rendered pork fat, pungent raw garlic, sharp aged cheese, all on a charred dough. It's not subtle.
I think it was probably both, depending on how hungry you were and how skilled the pizzaiolo was. But this is the crucial context for understanding why tomatoes eventually made it onto the dough. Tomatoes arrived in Europe from the New World in the 1520s, brought back by Spanish explorers. And for roughly 250 years, Europeans largely refused to eat them.
Because they thought tomatoes were poisonous.
They did, and the fear wasn't entirely irrational. Tomatoes are in the nightshade family, Solanaceae, which includes genuinely toxic plants like deadly nightshade and mandrake. The tomato plant's leaves and stems do contain toxic alkaloids, tomatine and solanine. And there was a secondary problem. Wealthy Europeans ate off pewter plates, which had high lead content. The acidity of tomatoes would leach lead out of the pewter, and people would get lead poisoning. They blamed the tomato, not the plate. So tomatoes got branded as dangerous for two different reasons, both of which made a certain kind of sense given what people knew at the time.
The tomato was the fugu fish of the Renaissance. Feared, avoided, blamed for deaths it didn't directly cause. And I have to ask, is the pewter plate thing actually documented? Or is that one of those food history just-so stories that sounds too neat?
It's documented in the sense that we know pewter with high lead content was common in upper-class European households, and we know the acid-leaching chemistry is real. What's harder to prove is a direct causal chain, that specific people got sick, that doctors specifically blamed the tomato, that this specific mechanism was the reason for the two-century avoidance. The written record from the period shows a general suspicion of tomatoes as cold and moist in the humoral medicine framework, and there are scattered references to them causing sickness. The pewter theory is a retrospective explanation that fits the facts, but it's probably one factor among several. The nightshade family resemblance was likely just as powerful a deterrent.
It's a plausible reconstruction rather than a smoking gun. But that actually makes the real story more interesting. It wasn't one thing keeping tomatoes off the table. It was a whole constellation of fears, some rational and some not.
It was poor Neapolitans who finally broke the taboo in the late 1700s. They weren't eating off pewter plates, they were eating off bread. The tomato's acidity actually helped preserve the flatbread in Naples' humid climate, which was a practical advantage for street vendors. Plus, tomatoes grew abundantly in the volcanic soil around Mount Vesuvius. So you had a convergence of factors, poverty, climate, local agriculture, and the preservative properties of the fruit itself.
It's always the poor who figure out what's actually edible, because necessity doesn't have the luxury of being picky. The rich were getting lead poisoning from their fancy plates while dock workers were inventing the food that would conquer the world. There's a whole theory of culinary history in that dynamic. The idea that nearly every great cuisine starts as peasant food and then gets gentrified.
We know roughly when this transition happened because of a specific document, Ippolito Cavalcanti's cookbook, La Cucina Teorico-Pratica, published in 1835. That's the first printed recipe for pizza con pomodoro, tomato pizza. Cavalcanti was a Neapolitan aristocrat, which is interesting. By the 1830s, pizza had climbed the social ladder enough that a nobleman was writing down the recipe. His version included tomato, mozzarella, and basil. That's essentially the Margherita, published 54 years before the supposed Margherita origin story.
The official origin myth has a paper trail that predates it by half a century. That's not a crack in the story. That's the story collapsing entirely. But I want to understand the mechanism here. How does a myth like that get started and then become so entrenched that UNESCO effectively endorses it?
Let's walk through the myth first, because it's so embedded in pizza culture that even a lot of pizzerias have it painted on their walls. The story goes that in June of 1889, Queen Margherita of Savoy visited Naples with King Umberto I. She was reportedly tired of the elaborate French cuisine served at court and wanted to try the local street food. The royal party summoned a pizzaiolo named Raffaele Esposito from a pizzeria that later became known as Pizzeria Brandi. Esposito made three pizzas, one with lard and cheese, one with anchovies, and one with tomato, mozzarella, and basil, the colors of the Italian flag. The queen loved the tricolor one, and Esposito named it after her.
There's even supposedly a thank you letter from the royal household.
There is a letter. It's displayed at Pizzeria Brandi to this day, allegedly signed by a court official named Camillo Galli. But food historians have examined it extensively, and the evidence is shaky. The letter is dated 1889, but the first documented mention of pizza margherita in any publication doesn't appear until 1906, 17 years after the supposed royal visit. That's a very long gap for something that supposedly became instantly famous. The name Margherita doesn't appear in any menu, any newspaper, any diary, any letter from the period. There's no contemporary corroboration at all.
17 years of silence. If the Queen of Italy publicly endorsed a street food and named it after herself, that would have been news. That would have been in every paper in Naples the next day. The absence of coverage is almost as damning as the presence of the earlier recipe.
There's another layer to this. The newly unified Kingdom of Italy in the 1880s was actively trying to construct a national identity, and food was part of that project. The idea of a pizza representing the tricolor flag, red tomato, white mozzarella, green basil, is exactly the kind of patriotic symbolism that a young nation trying to unify regional identities would embrace. It's almost too perfect as a national origin story.
Someone at Brandy probably did make a pizza for the Queen. The royal visit to Naples did happen. But the tricolor naming story was likely retrofitted years later. A marketing origin story that got absorbed as historical fact.
That's the consensus among food historians now. Zachary Nowak, who's done the most thorough research on this, argues that the margarita pizza was probably invented in the 1906 to 1910 period, and the Brandy family backdated the connection to the Queen's visit to give their pizzeria a royal pedigree. It's brilliant marketing, and it worked so well that it became official history. UNESCO's Intangible Cultural Heritage designation for Neapolitan pizza making in 2017 essentially enshrines a version of this story.
Which actually gets at something bigger. We're so desperate for origin stories, for a clean moment when someone invented something and named it, that we'll accept a fairy tale over the messy, gradual, undocumented reality. Pizza wasn't invented.
Accumulated is exactly the right word. And once tomatoes were firmly established as a pizza topping by the mid-1800s, the next phase of accumulation was geographical. Between 1880 and 1920, about 4 million Italians immigrated to the United States. Most of them were from southern Italy, Naples, Sicily, Calabria, and they brought their food with them. But pizza stayed confined to Italian neighborhoods for decades. It was an ethnic food, something you bought in Little Italy's, not something the average American knew about.
The first American pizzeria was Lombardi's, right?
Lombardi's on Spring Street in Manhattan, 1905. Gennaro Lombardi had been selling pizza from his grocery store, and he got a license to open a dedicated pizzeria. It's still there, or at least a version of it is. The original location closed and reopened nearby. But here's what's interesting. For the next 40 years, pizza barely spread beyond Italian-American communities. It wasn't until World War II that everything changed.
The GI effect.
American soldiers stationed in Italy during the war, particularly during the Allied invasion of Sicily and the march up the Italian peninsula, encountered pizza for the first time. They loved it. They came home wanting it. And suddenly, you had a built-in demand from millions of returning veterans who developed a taste for something that most Americans had never heard of.
This is such a specific and strange mechanism for culinary diffusion. It's not trade routes. It's not immigration patterns. Or rather, it's immigration plus military deployment plus return migration. The soldiers were essentially an accidental focus group of millions, forced deployed to a foreign cuisine, and then returned to their home markets with new preferences.
The timing was perfect. The post-war economic boom meant more disposable income, more leisure time, and the rise of car culture. Pizza was cheap, it was portable, it was shareable. It fit the emerging American lifestyle in ways that more formal ethnic cuisines didn't. By the 1950s, pizza was breaking out of the ethnic enclaves. Frank Sinatra was eating it. Dean Martin was singing about it. When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. That song came out in 1953. Pizza was becoming American.
That's when the chainification started.
Shakey's Pizza Parlor opened in 1954 in Sacramento. Pizza Hut launched in 1958 in Wichita, Kansas, founded by two brothers, Dan and Frank Carney, who borrowed $600 from their mother to buy used equipment. By the 1970s, Pizza Hut was a global franchise. Domino's followed in 1960, founded by Tom Monahan in Ypsilanti, Michigan. What's wild is the speed. Within about 25 years of World War II ending, pizza had gone from a niche ethnic food to one of the most popular foods in America.
Pizza Hut today serves something like 3 million pizzas a day globally.
3 million a day across more than 18,000 locations in over 100 countries. Compare that to the roughly 100 certified Veris Pizza Napolitana pizzerias in the United States. The AVPN, the Associazione Verace Pizza Napolitana, was founded in 1984 specifically to push back against what was happening to pizza as it went global. They saw the chainification, the deep dish, the stuffed crust, the pineapple, and they said, someone has to define what real pizza actually is.
The pizza police.
Their rules are incredibly specific. San Marzano tomatoes grown in the volcanic soil of Campania. Buffalo mozzarella from Campania or Lazio. 00 flour with specific protein content. The dough must be kneaded by hand or with a low-speed mixer. It must rise for at least 8 hours. The pizza must be shaped by hand, no rolling pins. it must be baked in a wood-fired oven at 485 degrees Celsius for 60 to 90 seconds. The resulting pizza must be soft and elastic, foldable, with a raised cornicione, the crust rim that shows proper leoparding, those charred spots from the intense heat.
If you use a rolling pin, they send someone to your house?
No certification, at least. And certification matters to a certain kind of pizzeria because it's a marketing signal. It says, we're not Pizza Hut, we're not Domino's, we're the real thing. But here's the irony. The AVPN standards describe a pizza that didn't exist until the late 20th century. Neapolitan pizza in the 1800s was cooked at lower temperatures, often with whatever cheese was available, and the strict regional sourcing rules are a modern invention. The association is preserving a tradition that was never as uniform as they claim.
Authenticity is just the moment you decide to freeze the frame. Everything before that is evolution. Everything after is corruption. But I want to push on this because there's a genuine tension here. On one hand, the AVPN rules are arbitrary and ahistorical. On the other hand, without some kind of standard, the term Neapolitan pizza becomes meaningless. If Domino's can call their pizza Neapolitan, does the word still convey any useful information?
That's the central tension in all food certification systems. Parmesan, champagne, Kobe beef. They're simultaneously protectionist marketing schemes and genuine attempts to preserve craft knowledge. The AVPN rules do capture something real about a specific style of pizza that emerged in Naples and that requires real skill to execute. The 60-second bake at 900 degrees isn't arbitrary. It produces a texture you literally cannot get any other way, so I'm not dismissing the whole enterprise. I'm just noting that the story they tell about themselves, that they're preserving an ancient, unchanging tradition, isn't historically accurate.
Every culture that adopted pizza has frozen the frame differently. In Japan, you get mayonnaise and corn pizza, and it's not a fringe thing, it's mainstream. Domino's Japan sells a mayo jaga pizza with mayonnaise, potato, and corn. In Brazil, green peas are a standard pizza topping. In Sweden, there's banana curry pizza, which sounds like a dare but is popular. In India, paneer tikka pizza. In Australia, barbecue sauce base with bacon and egg.
Each of these would cause an AVPN inspector to have a medical event.
Here's what I find fascinating about the Japanese case. Corn and mayonnaise on pizza sounds like a joke to American ears, but it's actually a completely logical adaptation. Japanese cuisine already pairs corn and mayonnaise in other contexts. Corn salad, corn on ramen, corn in okonomiyaki. So when pizza arrived in Japan, it got absorbed into an existing flavor vocabulary. That's not corruption. That's exactly how culinary diffusion has always worked. The Romans didn't import garum from Greece and then keep it pure. They put their own spin on it.
The Brazilian green pea is the same story. Brazilian cuisine has a strong tradition of peas in savory dishes. They show up in chicken pot pie, in rice dishes, in salads. Putting them on pizza isn't random, it's drawing from an existing pantry. Every culture that adopts a foreign food does this. It's the culinary equivalent of speaking a language with an accent. The underlying structure is recognizable, but the surface features reflect the speaker's native phonology.
All of these are legitimate expressions of what pizza is, a flatbread with toppings, adapted to local ingredients and local tastes. That's what pizza has always been. The Neapolitan poor in the 1700s weren't consulting an authenticity rulebook. They were using what they had. The Japanese pizzaiolo, adding corn and mayo, is doing the exact same thing.
There's a deeper point here about how food traditions actually work. We talk about dishes being invented, but most of what we eat is the result of multiple independent discoveries, parallel evolution, and gradual convergence. Flatbreads with toppings appear independently in cultures all over the world. The Chinese have scallion pancakes. The Middle East has manakish with za'atar. Alsace has tarte flambé with crème fraîche and bacon. None of these are pizza, but they're all pizza adjacent. They're solving the same culinary problem with local materials.
The tarte flambé is actually the perfect parallel because it's essentially a white pizza from a different tradition. It was originally a bread dough rolled thin, topped with crème fraîche, bacon, and onions, and baked in a wood-fired oven. The Alsatian farmers who invented it had never heard of Naples. They just independently arrived at the same solution. Take your staple starch, add fat and protein, apply intense heat. It's convergent evolution in the kitchen.
The modern revival of Neapolitan-style pizza in the 2010s is its own kind of convergence. You had chefs like Chris Bianco in Phoenix, who started making wood-fired pizzas in the late 1980s and became, essentially, the godfather of the American artisanal pizza movement. You had the Netflix documentary effect, shows like Chef's Table and Ugly Delicious putting pizza makers in front of global audiences. You had the rise of portable wood-fired ovens like Uni, which let home cooks hit those 900-degree temperatures in their backyard. Suddenly, Neapolitan-style pizza was aspirational in a way it hadn't been since the margarita myth was first concocted.
All of this raises the question of what pizza even is anymore. Is a Domino's pepperoni pizza the same food as a certified Neapolitan margarita? They share a name, a basic structure, and a lineage, but they're solving different problems for different people in different contexts.
The way I think about it is that pizza is a platform, not a dish. It's an architecture, a carbohydrate substrate with toppings that can support almost infinite variation. The AVPN version is one app on the platform. Pizza Hut is another. The Brazilian green pea pizza is another. They're all pizza, just as a pickup truck and a Formula One car are both automobiles. The platform is what traveled. The implementations are what adapted.
Which brings us back to the dough. Because if pizza is a platform, the dough is the operating system. And this is where most home cooks get it wrong.
This is my favorite thing to talk about. The single biggest variable in pizza quality at home isn't the oven temperature. It's not the toppings. It's not even the flour. It's fermentation time. A same-day dough, mixed and baked within a few hours, will produce a pizza that tastes fine. But a dough that's cold fermented for 72 hours develops completely different flavor compounds.
What's happening chemically? Walk me through the 72 hours.
During a long cold fermentation, the yeast is working slowly, very slowly, and it's producing not just carbon dioxide, but a range of organic acids, esters, and alcohols that contribute to flavor. The protease enzymes in the flour are breaking down proteins into amino acids, which then participate in Maillard reactions during baking. That's browning and complex savory flavors. The amylase enzymes are breaking starches into simpler sugars, which caramelize in the oven. A 72-hour dough has a depth and complexity that a 3-hour dough simply cannot achieve, because those enzymatic processes take time. It's not a subtle difference. You can taste it.
The home cook who decides at 4 p.m. that they want pizza for dinner has already lost the game before they've started.
They haven't lost, but they're playing a different game. If you want great pizza at home, you need to start the dough on Thursday for Sunday dinner, and you don't need a wood-fired oven. A regular home oven at 500 degrees Fahrenheit with a pizza steel or a thick baking stone that's been preheating for an hour will get you 80% of the way to a Neapolitan-style result. The steel is actually better than a stone for home ovens because it conducts heat faster. It transfers more energy to the dough in the first 30 seconds of baking, which is when the oven spring happens.
The oven spring being that dramatic puff of the cornicione. I've seen it happen and it still feels like magic every time. You put a flat disc of dough in the oven and 90 seconds later it's inflated into this pillowy charred ring.
That's the moment when the water in the dough flashes to steam and the trapped carbon dioxide expands, creating those big, airy bubbles in the crust. You need intense bottom heat for that. A pizza steel gives you that. A lot of the gear obsession in pizza making, the imported ovens, the specific flours, is about chasing the last 10%. The first 90% is technique and patience.
The 72-hour cold ferment is the one thing a home cook should change if they change nothing else.
That, and using a scale instead of measuring cups. Flour amounts by volume are wildly inconsistent. A cup of flour can vary by 30% depending on how it's scooped. With pizza dough, the hydration ratio matters. If you're targeting 65% hydration, which is a good place to start for home ovens, you need to know exactly how much water you're adding relative to flour. Grams, not cups.
Hydration ratio is just the weight of water divided by the weight of flour, expressed as a percentage.
So if you have 500 grams of flour and you add 325 grams of water, that's 65% hydration. That's wet enough to give you an open, airy crumb, but not so wet that the dough is impossible to handle. If you go up to 70 or 75%, you get even more oven spring and a more open structure, but the dough becomes very sticky and difficult to shape. That's where a lot of beginners get frustrated and add more flour, which defeats the purpose.
It's funny that we've ended up at practical pizza making advice, because the history of this food is basically a 3,000-year arc from necessity to craft to commodity, and now back to craft again. We're living through the craft revival of something that started as the cheapest possible street food for people who couldn't afford plates.
That arc isn't finished. The next chapter might be driven by something we haven't really grappled with yet, climate change and agricultural disruption. Tomatoes are sensitive to heat stress. Yields drop significantly when temperatures exceed certain thresholds during flowering. Wheat is vulnerable to drought. The San Marzano tomato, specifically, is grown in a region of Campania that's already experiencing more frequent extreme weather events.
We might see a future where the ABPN has to relax its geographic restrictions because the ingredients literally can't be grown in the designated regions anymore. Which would be deeply ironic. The authenticity police forced to redefine authenticity by forces entirely outside their control.
Or we might see entirely new pizza traditions emerge from places that are currently too cold for tomatoes, but won't be for much longer. Imagine a Neapolitan-style pizza culture developing in, say, southern England or the Pacific Northwest because the climate has shifted enough to support tomato cultivation. Or we might see ingredient substitutions that sound radical now, insect-based proteins, as toppings, lab-grown mozzarella, flour made from drought-resistant grains that aren't wheat.
The pizza of 2070 might be cricket pepperoni on a sorghum crust with cultured casein cheese, and some future version of the AVPN will be insisting that anything else isn't authentic. The cycle just keeps repeating.
They'll be wrong in exactly the same way the current authenticity police are wrong. Pizza is adaptation. That's what it's always been. The Neapolitan poor who first put tomatoes on their flatbreads weren't preserving a tradition. They were breaking one. They were adding a feared New World fruit to a dish that had been white for centuries. They were the innovators. The traditionalists of their day probably thought tomato pizza was a bizarre and possibly dangerous fad.
Every tradition is just an innovation that outlived its critics. And I think that's actually the most useful way to think about food history in general. We tend to imagine that dishes have these pure, authentic origins that get diluted over time. But the real story is almost always the opposite. Dishes start as mongrel adaptations, and the purity gets imposed later by people who want to draw boundaries.
Which is a good place to land. The history of pizza isn't a straight line from ancient flatbreads to your delivery box. It's a series of accidents, adaptations, and marketing stories that got mistaken for history. The tomato took 300 years to go from feared poison to pizza staple. The margarita origin myth is probably a fabrication. The global spread happened because of war, migration, and franchising, not because of any inherent superiority of the dish. And yet here we are, eating 3 million Pizza Hut pizzas a day while also venerating 60-second wood-fired pies as cultural heritage.
The same food, holding both positions simultaneously. That's either a contradiction or a testament to how flexible the idea of pizza really is.
I think it's both. And I think the home cook who does a 72-hour cold ferment in their own kitchen, with their own oven, using whatever toppings they like, is participating in the same tradition as the 18th century Neapolitan pizzaiolo, making something good from what's available, adapting as they go, not waiting for permission from a certification board.
That's a better origin story than the queen and the flag, honestly. The real tradition of pizza is that there is no single tradition. It's a 1400-year game of telephone played with flour, water, and whatever's lying around. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact. In the 1860s, a lighthouse keeper on the Chatham Islands kept a handwritten logbook in which he recorded mysterious lunar glows he called moon vapors, describing them in the margins next to his daily weather entries as a pale milky effusion, quite unlike cloud, seeming to rise from the surface of the moon itself. A lighthouse keeper seeing things on the moon and just jotting it down between wind speed readings. The casualness of that is almost the best part. No panic, no grand pronouncement, just moon vapors, and on to the next entry.
Sounds like a candle scent. This has been My Weird Props. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more people find the show. You can find every episode and full transcripts at myweirdprompts.com. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Corn. We'll be back next week with another prompt.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.